Well, one of the things that I've loved over the last few days as we received the news of the Queen's death is just some of the portraits that have come out. There's just been some amazing, beautiful pictures. Here's the first photograph of the Queen as Queen and the last photograph of her taken as Queen. It's beautiful. And there is just so many in between. There are oils and acrylics and watercolors and so many photographs, some flattering and some not flattering, some formal and some informal, some young, some old, just so many pictures. She's got to be probably the most photographed woman in history, I think, certainly the most photographed monarch. Well, as you open up the Old Testament, you get a series of portraits and photographs of God's people. We haven't got everything captured in the history of God's people, but we have significant moments, some flattering, some unflattering, some formal, some informal, some as Israel are mature in the faith, some when they are just like toddlers. And today we get one of those moments where we see not a flattering portrait by any shape or size. It's one of the most famous portraits of the most famous incidents in the life of God's people, the golden calf, where God's people swap worship of Yahweh, their God, for worship of a man-made sculpted cow. It's incredible. And this incident is in our Bibles. When I'm studying the Bible, I always want to try and work out why this incident is in our Bibles. And I think this incident is in our Bibles to show us what our human hearts look like, left to their own devices, what they look like, and to warn us, to open our eyes about our human hearts, to see how habitually we swap the right worship of God for the false worship of man-made things of this world, and how we run from our good and gracious God and do our own thing. And it's against this portrait of our hearts that we see a portrait of our good and gracious God, of his heart and his kindness and his king that he delivers in history for us. I don't know what you've come with here today. Maybe there is a particular sin that just keeps coming back at you like a boomerang. Maybe you've come here with frustration of your own inability not to trust God with your whole life. Maybe the death of Betty or the death of the Queen has you questioning the very foundations on which you're building your life, and you questioning why you don't trust the Lord with your whole life. Today, as we look at this incident, and it's a bizarre, famous, just ridiculous incident, what I want us to see is that no matter whether we're here broken, despairing, or whether we're doing okay, what I want us to see is that we have a faithful God who can be trusted with our whole lives, with anything that this world throws at us, anything that comes out of our hearts. So I've got three portraits for us this morning. The first is this. Today we see a portrait of the human heart, a portrait of the human heart. The story of the golden calf is an incredibly famous story, isn't it? But as I read it, I've forgotten just how ridiculous the thing is. And it's almost comical, isn't it? I'm really glad that we laughed when Paul finished the reading. Let me read from verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, Moses had been up the mountain getting the Ten Commandments from the Lord, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make gods for us who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Aaron gathers up all the people and gathers up all the bling that they have, their earrings, their jewelry, their watches, their whatever. Verse 4, he took the gold from them, formed it in a mold, and cast an image of a calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." It's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy. They made this golden calf. They say, "This is the gods who rescued you from Egypt." And as you read through the story, as Paul read through the story, it gets more ridiculous verse by verse. It just snowballs into this land of ridiculous. Moses is up the mountain. He's been up there for 5 weeks, 40 days, 40 nights. He's been meeting with God. He's been receiving the Ten Commandments. And the meeting is cut short by verse 7, when God says, "Go down at once. Your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. They have cast for themselves an image of a calf." Perhaps my favorite moment in this whole incident is when Moses comes down and he confronts Aaron for making the golden calf. And his reply comes straight out of a 7-year-old's playbook when dad's caught him stealing biscuits from the jar. Let me read verse 23. This is Aaron. He said, "They said to me, the people, 'Make us gods who should go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' So I said to them, 'Whoever has gold, take it off.' So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's absolutely ridiculous. There's blame, there's excuses, there's lies. And at this point, we're meant to be thinking Garden of Eden. We're also meant to be thinking of that moment when your dad catches you doing something that you clearly have done, but you deny. The dog did it. My brother did it. You know that kind of moment when you blame anything but yourself. Now, you can read the commentators, and they go to town debating whether God's people broke the first commandment or the second commandment or both. Was their crime when they... Was their crime that they went against God when they said, "You shall have no other gods before me"? Or was their crime their disobedience to God's second commandment, you shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that it is in the water under the earth? You should not bow down to them or worship them." Was it command one, or was it command two, or was it both? The people do say, it's recorded in our Bibles, the people do say, "Come make us gods," plural, for us to go before us. And they do make an idol in the form of this calf, and they worship it. The difficulty in answering which commandment they broke is that the Hebrew word for gods, which our translation translates gods, is ambiguous. We don't know whether it's plural or singular. And Aaron does seem to bring the whole thing back to Yahweh by dedicating a festival day to the Lord at the end of verse 5. Now, what I think is going on here is that although the people have come out of Egypt, they've been rescued out of Egypt, Egypt has not come out of them. They've come out of Egypt, but Egypt has not come out of them. See, their hearts are still worshipping like Egyptians. They may be God's people, but their hearts beat like Egyptians. They dance like Egyptians. They walk like Egyptians. The Egyptians had a suite of gods who they manipulated and controlled for their own ends. Everything about the Egyptian life had a god, and it had a symbol attached to that god. They had this God for this, that God for that. They had an image of God for this and an image of God for that. And Hathor, the Egyptian god Hathor, who was the god of motherhood, she was depicted as a cow. We saw her in the plagues of Egypt when we saw the plagues of the livestock, God deliberately sending down plagues against the gods of Egypt. And here they are, they return back to this Egyptian worship. And it seems that the Israelites spiritually hadn't left Egypt. Now, one of the big problems with creating an image of God and the reason behind the second commandment is that Yahweh wasn't meant to be defined by a statue or an animal. He was meant to be defined by what he does. You weren't meant to have a picture of God. You weren't meant to have a statue of God. You were meant to know who God was by what he did. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of the Egyptians. God defines himself to his people by what he does. And so at the heart of the crime of God's people was that they wanted a God who they could box. They wanted a God who they could see, who they could touch in their Egyptian way of doing things. They wanted a God who they could control, who they could put parameters on. A God who was with them, a God who they could see, a God who they could touch. John Calvin, in his commentary on this, writes this: in this narrative, we perceive the detestable impiety of the people, their worse than base ingratitude, and their monstrous madness mixed with stupidity. Could they not see the pillar of fire and the cloud? Was not God's paternal solicitude abundantly conspicuous every day in the manna? Was he not near them in ways innumerable? Good point, isn't it? They saw God. They experienced God. They saw what he did. They knew that God was with them, but yet they want this calf. Now, the danger when you read this story is you get your finger out and you start wagging at Israel. Look at them, silly old Israel. Haven't they done a terrible thing? But yet when you look closely, when you dig deeper, you know that they've got the same hearts as us. You know that our hearts have the same desire for the created, the same desire for tangible things over the presence of God. John Calvin also wrote that the human heart is a factory of idols. Every one of us from his mother's womb, expert in inventing idols. It's true, isn't it? We want a God who we can control, who we can box, who we can contain, who we can manipulate. A God that we can make. Maybe you see that in yourself. I wonder whether you ever find yourself saying, I see God more like such and such. I see God more like this. Or maybe you find yourself projecting God on one issue, that you have given God just one problem to solve in your life. One test, one thing to solve, that if God can deal with this one thing, then he'll have your whole allegiance. Maybe you find yourself doing that. We love to restrict God to compartments of our lives, don't we? We love to restrict him to Sundays, confine him to religion. Hey, we've got a cupboard over here. To lock the door on God. A little, what's it called? An aubrey. We love to replace God with other things, to contain him. We make gods out of things like romance and love and material possessions and a bright green glowing lawn. We love to make gods out of things like financial security. I remember in my 20s thinking about my idols and thinking that my idol was not money or a career or success, but financial security. And I worked and worshipped everything so that I would be secure. Our passage shows us how much we like to control God, to contain him, to restrict him. It shows us that that comes instinctively to us. But it also shows us how wrong it is, because we also not only get a portrait of our hearts, but we get a portrait of our God. Just look with me at verse 7. Open your Bibles if you close them. At verse 7, the Lord said to Moses, "Go down at once. Your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have acted perversely. They've been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. They've cast for themselves an image of a calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" Verse 9, the Lord said to Moses, "I've seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And of you I will make a great nation." Key verse here is, "Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them." It's a scary, sobering verse, isn't it? Scary, sobering verse that God wants to destroy this people because they have created this calf. But yet, as you read this story, you can feel, you just know the justness of it. That God is right because God's people have given God a two-finger salute and created this calf and said, "Here's our gods." There's a sense of in which you can sympathize with God when he says, "Let me alone so that I can destroy them. And I'll start again with you, Moses." But the story doesn't stop there, does it? We hear, but Moses implored the Lord his God. And Moses goes and he intercedes on behalf of the people. And he appeals to God. He appeals to God as Father. He says, "These are your people, your firstborn. Why would you destroy them?" He appeals to the work that he's accomplished in rescuing his people out of Egypt. He appeals to God on the basis of his reputation. Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them? He appeals on the basis of his character. And then finally, he appeals on the basis of God's promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel to make a great nation out of this people, that he would be their God and they would be his people. And then we get the big bombshell of the story, verse 14. "And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he had planned to bring on his people." Now, when you read this, and someone that I was reading this with this week said, "They don't teach you that in Sunday school, do they?" The problem that this brings is the concept of God changing his mind. You see, we believe in a God who is all-knowing and all-changing. Isaiah 40, "The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable." Malachi 3, "For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed." The problem with this verse is the problem of a God who can change his mind about his people and therefore could change his mind about you and me. But God is not like a child. He's not like my son, Henry, who changes his mind when he goes in to choose a treat in Kmart. If you want to waste an hour, take Henry to Kmart. He cannot make up his mind. God is not like that. He does not change his mind. Now, we don't have time to discuss the intricacies, and you can discuss the intricacies of this problem over morning tea, but I just want to offer a few things to help us get to the bottom of it. And it's important that we get to the bottom of it because it has important implications for us. The first thing I want to say is that our Bible translation, the NRSV, has not done us any favors when it's translated this phrase, change his mind. It makes God sound human-like. It makes him sound like a toddler in Kmart. The actual word is more like relent. And to relent is to withdraw rather than to change one's mind. The Lord doesn't change his mind here. He withdraws his anger. Now, it's not that he was talked down off the ledge by Moses. It's more like Moses interceding shows us the means by which you can avert the disaster of God, bringing down his wrath on his people. Rather than changing God's plans, Moses is part of God's plan. Now let me read from verse 30. On the next day, Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin, but now I'll go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now if you will only forgive their sin, but if not, blot me out of the book that you have written." You see, Moses doesn't change the plans of the Lord. Moses is part of the plans of the Lord. He is a character on stage to show us the solution at averting facing God's wrath. And what does he show us? He shows us how he offers himself as a sacrifice for the people. He says, "Blot me out of the book rather than your people." Verse 33, "But the Lord said to Moses, 'Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. See, my angel shall go in front of you. Nevertheless, when the day comes for punishment, I will punish them for their sin.'" See, what we see here is the right idea, but the wrong person. Moses shows us that what is needed is for the Lord to relent. And what is needed for the Lord to relent is a sacrifice or a substitute. He offers to allow the Lord to destroy him rather than his people. But Moses is Moses. And his sacrifice is not sufficient for all of God's people. And what it shows us then is that God's anger can't be brushed under the carpet. Israel's sin can't just be forgotten about. It needs to fall somewhere. God's wrath needs to go somewhere. It needs to be absorbed. It needs to be averted. It needs to be put on something that is not God's people for them not to face destruction. So here we see a picture of our sin, a picture of our hearts, and we see a picture of a holy God who hates sin but loves sinners, who is rightly angry at his people for going in and moving in with the house next door, of not worshipping him with their whole hearts, but worshipping other things. See a picture of his holiness, his wrath. But we also see a picture of his grace and his relenting and his kindness. And here we get, centuries before, we get a picture of the cross. That's our final portrait this morning. We see a picture of the cross. You see, at the heart of the cross, we see Jesus doing what Moses could not do. On the cross, we see Jesus interceding for God's people, acting as a substitute on behalf of God's people. And he does what Moses could not do, because Moses was imperfect. Jesus was perfect. And so he's qualified as a perfect substitute to die, to be destroyed instead of God's people. The one perfect human being in history to obey God's law perfectly, who didn't sin, goes to the cross so that God's anger and God's wrath at Israel's sin and all the sin that happened ever since Genesis 3, right through the Old Testament, right through the time in between the Testaments, right before Jesus, right through our history books, right through our lives, right through our church, Jesus goes to the cross so that God would pour his anger down on Jesus instead of you and me. Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, so that anyone and everyone who believes in him will not perish, will not come under God's judgment and wrath, but will receive eternal life. In this is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for sins. Moses, at this point in God's people's history, shows us, gives us a hint of the solution of a sinful people and a holy God. When Jesus dies on the cross, the full force of God's anger comes down on him, comes crashing down on Jesus, the perfect, spotless Lamb, so that it wouldn't come down on you and me. Jesus rises from the dead, he ascends into heaven, and gives us his Spirit. It's a beautiful solution to a problem that we see here, acted out in around a golden calf. God gives us his Spirit. He takes our hearts of stone, the prophet says. Takes our hearts of stone that cannot obey God, that can only go towards golden calves, and gives us a heart of flesh so that we can obey him, so that we can know freedom, so that we can know the good life that we talked about last week. And you cannot earn that. No religion, no ritual, no performance, no pedigree can earn you that right, can earn you that freedom, can earn you the gift of being able to obey God. It is the beauty and the truth of the gospel that God gives us this gift of perfect forgiveness and the ability and the regeneration so that we might obey him and know the good life. So if you're one here, if you're here and you know that you put God in a box, you know that you restrict him to Sundays, you know that you have confined him to one area of your life and you have kept him out of the other areas of your life. If that's you, my guess is that you're miserable because you've confined God to this particular aspect, to a day, to an area of your life. And it will pull you apart. It will make you anxious. It will make you unassured. It will make you a slave to that one area of your life. It won't lead to freedom. If that's you, I want to encourage you to relinquish control to the God who loves you, who gave himself up for you, who went to the cross to die for you instead of you and because of you, and who hands you a life of freedom. So embrace it. Love him, trust him, because one day you'll be with him forever in eternity as his precious child. Let's pray.